The Open Society Monitoring Index that is being launched today, this evening, at face value, aims to help us take a barometer reading on the degree of openness of our South African society. But it does much more than that. In my opinion, the OSMI, I'm going to abbreviate it to that so that you know what I'm talking about. The OSMI does at least three things. Firstly, the OSMI does indeed offer us a baseline measure against which we can monitor progress or retreat from openness over time. There will undoubtedly be many critics of the OSMI. Some will take issue with the choice of the thematic indicators that are taken as measures of the society's openness. Now, I imagine that you probably haven't read it yet. I somehow thought that it would be introduced more before our talks, and so that point, when you read it, you will recognize that there are a number of themes, and there's a choice of which themes constitute openness. And I have no doubt that some, particularly in the academic community, will take issue with that. Some will take issue with some will be uncomfortable with just the very attempt to put a quantitative measure on a set of what are really very qualitative indicators on degrees of freedom, degrees of accountability, degrees of political will. How do you put a number to that? Is that a meaningful exercise? Some will take issue with the choice of the 25 experts whose subjective opinions on some 63 questions are the core of the methodology. How can one be sure that a different 25 experts might not have produced a very different set of scores? But while the OSMI's absolute measure, therefore, might well be challenged by methodological critiques, it nevertheless, in my view, achieves this first goal of providing a set of relative values. We may not agree on the absolute values, but relative values which can be compared over time and which, if followed forwards longitudinally and repeated, will help to highlight in aggregate the extent, the specific trends that affect our judgment of whether we are moving towards a more open society or away from that. And hopefully will help raise the early warning flags when we are in retreat rather than in advance. Secondly, the OSMI, in order to develop the criteria that were used methodologically in which to measure openness, it gets the debate going, because I think we often talk about the open society in a glib way without being very clear what we mean. And so having to define these themes, having to define questions which you would answer in order to make that judgment, it gets the debate going about what would count as progress or retreat from the goals of the open society. That debate in itself, distinct from the findings, is an educative process for the polity, for all of us, for citizens and for government. We know we want a more open society. Do we really know what we have to do to achieve that? And I think the OSMI helps us take that debate forward significantly. And I want to make the point that it challenges both the left and the right. It challenges liberals and conservatives. It challenges nationalists, statists, communitarians, to engage with the principal Popperian idea of the open society. That idea is that just as scientists, because as you know, Popper was both a philosopher of science, and in some ways he's much better known for his philosophy of science, but also a political philosopher. And the two are remarkably well integrated, those two themes of his work. So the principal idea is, just as scientists can never know the truth, and scientific progress is in fact, that he argues, the result of progressive sequential falsification of the current received wisdom, and as we falsify a hypothesis, we move closer to knowing the truth, but we never know that we have the truth. Similarly, no political party or government or academic analyst can know for certain that their policies are the right policies or the best way, and that only repeated subjection of these policies to public scrutiny and to the vibrant, as he calls it, marketplace of ideas can improve on public policy. This must extend even to the holy cows, such as, for example, the death penalty. People often think that the open society idea is synonymous with a whole lot of tenets of liberalism that we hold dear, such as a Bill of Rights, But the idea of a Bill of Rights, several of those rights, or the idea of certain principles that we hold dear as inviolable, as not challengeable, even by courts, as something which laws are tested against, that idea is inimical to the idea of the open society. The open society requires that we acknowledge that we don't know the truth. We don't know whether, for certain, the death penalty is a good or a bad thing. We must always be open to questioning it. There would be clauses in the Bill of Rights, in fundamental aspects of the Constitution, which have to be tested. Nothing should be sacrosanct. There should be no holy cows. So, therefore, the open society ideas are a challenge, not only to conservatives, to statists, but also to liberals, also to people who hold constitutional principles dear. So it must extend from challenging that to, on the other hand, of course, challenges to ideas that that the developmental state is the right way to go, or that economic policies or customary law are things that can't be changed and must be respected simply because there are strong groups that believe in them. So I think the OSMI does us this great service of challenging us to think about what is it that we mean when we talk about an open society, and to disaggregate those elements. And thirdly, the OSMI disaggregates the constituent elements of the requirements for an open society into, on the one hand, the enabling conditions, such as the institutional and legislative arrangements, such as, for example, the protection of freedom of speech, the proactive interventions required on the part of the state in order to ensure that an open society exists, which includes the need to resource a whole lot of activities. The OSMI makes the point, and I think much more clearly than perhaps some of us, well, at least those of us who don't work in that field all the time, those of us who read this in the newspapers, don't appreciate the extent to which the OSMI or the open society requirements are not just the enabling legal structure, but also the proactive requirements on the state, the resourcing of those of that society. But crucially, and I think for me one of the most interesting insights of the OSMI, is that all the other conditions can be in place: the transparency, the information flow, the accountability mechanisms, the multi-party, the electoral systems, and multi-party elections. All of that can be explained, and yet those are only the necessary conditions, not the sufficient conditions for an open society. They are not sufficient in the absence of citizens, individuals, and non-government agencies fulfilling their own roles, the roles of active citizenship. In disaggregating these elements and analysing them individually, we are also pointed in the direction of how to intervene to make our society more open, rather than just bemoaning the government's or the ruling party's actions and attitudes. To quote from the report, quote, "These scores indicate that South Africa is neither doing particularly well nor particularly poorly on any of the three primary dimensions of openness that the OSMI evaluates. On the whole, respondents felt that the openness in South Africa is least compromised by the design of the formal institutions and legal mechanisms governing each of the substantive areas, such as elections, such as free speech, such as freedom of association. Respondents' high regard for the quality of the rules that structure public life suggests that the foundations for open society in South Africa are both present and sound." That was the one set of findings. However, the scores also indicate that citizens' engagement with the formal rules and institutions, as well as the government's commitment to preserving their integrity and functioning, which they summarized as its political will, are the primary threats to openness in contemporary South Africa. So it is the citizens' failure to take their responsibility seriously that is the primary threat to an open society. Now, I think that's an interesting finding of the OSMI. So the report contrasts two findings: positive findings on the legal institutional scaffolding and safeguards that enable an open society, and rather negative findings on the implementation of those of the requirements of an open society, and particularly on citizens' engagement. Now, I want to comment on these two aspects in turn. So let me start with the legal and institutional scaffolding. In spite of the findings that the laws and constitutional provisions that currently provide that enabling framework for an open society, which is this key dimension or the free flow of information, in spite of the fact that they appear to be in place. The information, I would argue, we would all argue, and the chair introduced it, the free flow of information currently at this moment, in this last few weeks, has come under serious threat. The current proposals must ring alarm bells for all of us as to how fragile these rules are, even though the rules are there. I refer, of course, firstly to the Protection of Public Information Bill, but Dr. Rampele is going to address this at some length in her talk, and so I'm not going to say anything about that. That's also had a lot of coverage in the press. I want to speak instead about the other current threat to the rules and institutions that protect the freedom of the print, which is the rules and free and institutions that protect the freedom of the printed press. And this is, of course, the ANC's proposal, first in its Polokwane resolution in 2007, and now in its more recent document, which is going to the National General Council in September, which proposes a parliamentary media tribunal. Let me say in parentheses that there are several proposals in the ANC discussion document which are positively supportive of an open society, and we should not dismiss the throw out the baby with the bathwater. For example, the document, a requirement of the open society is that ordinary citizens should be able to make their voices heard on matters of public interest and policy. The ANC paper proposes a toll-free SMS facility to public broadcasters so that poorer people's opinions are readily heard. And that's an interesting thing. You watch television, you see all these messages stream out, and there's a proposal that says we would get more of the poor voice on that banner on TV if there was a toll-free line for SMSs, for example. Another proposal, that public broadcasters be less dependent on commercial support, would clearly allow the broadcaster to air views and programs which are not dependent on popularity amongst viewers and marketers, allowing greater diversity of views to be publicised. Another ongoing theme is the greater diversity of ownership, recognising that the limited number of publishers is likely to reflect the interests of limited and particular sectors of society. So, recognising that the document has elements which can promote and should promote an open society in which I believe we should all support. However, the proposed Parliamentary Appeals Tribunal is a lethal threat to the open society. Allow me briefly to review what it is and the arguments for and against it. The media tribunal would be appointed by Parliament. It would be available as an appeal structure when anyone believes that the media has acted irresponsibly or unfairly. It would have the power to fine and imprison journalists and publishers, and perhaps even to ban them from publishing. And I have some quotes, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to quote from the document, but just a very, I'm not going to quote at length. A short quote is from Jackson Mtemba, the ANC national spokesperson, who said in the Mail and Guardian, if journalists have to be fired because they don't contribute to the South Africa we want, then let it be so. So firing journalists is the same as banning them from publishing. Some authority to ensure responsible reporting is not in itself a bad thing. If journalists could not be held to account for publishing scandalous or partisan stories on flimsy, unconfirmed evidence, then we, the public, would never know whether to trust what we read or not. The open society would hardly be well served if anyone who could afford to publish a news sheet were free to confabulate stories simply for the sake of entertaining the readers while passing it off as the truth. So a reliable and trustworthy press is essential to an open society, and we need to be sure that we have institutions in place that do guarantee us that we have a reliable and trustworthy press. It doesn't happen on its own. Why then the attack on the tribunal proposal? Some critics argue that it is not necessary, so that's the first reason for the attack, because we have other laws related particularly to defamation, which can be used to keep journalists honest. But let's recognise that fighting defamation cases often takes months or years to set the record straight. Secondly, it's often costly, and particularly for individuals who have been defamed. And if they're fighting big media companies, they will often not be able to take on those battles. And thirdly, the laws of defamation are limited to natural persons, not to organisations. So the ANC, for example, cannot claim it has been defamed, no matter how untrue or unkind the story. Fourthly, it's hardly possible for every, it's hardly ever possible for a public figure to claim that his or her reputation is compromised, even if a report is untrue, because often their reputations are compromised for all sorts of other reasons. So a false allegation doesn't make it a whole lot worse. But the point is, public figures are regarded as fair game by the courts, and therefore they can't win anti-defamation cases. Not, I'm generalizing and I'm overstating that. But indeed, I think we should not simply say, well, the defamation system, litigation system is there, and we don't need anything else. It's not enough to ensure that we have a responsible and trustworthy press. It is necessary to have more protection than offered by the courts through defamation litigation. Now, the most commonly used additional safeguard is usually through press councils, structures which are created by the newspapers themselves, and the press councils appoint a press ombudsman. This is a quick process, doesn't take months or years, usually a matter of days. A complaint can be adjudicated and results in a quick response, usually a published apology. The criticism of this mechanism is that it lacks teeth and cannot punish. Yet that is precisely the key criticism of the proposed tribunal. In other words, that it can punish. For even though the tribunal would act after the fact, in other words, it responds to a complaint about something that has already been published, dispensing punishing fines and jail sentences will in a short time have the effect of creating a withering self-censorship. There is also an argument that the ombudsman, so in other words, what the criticism of the tribunal proposal is that the punishment, even though it's after the fact, leads to censorship, and people cannot, if they cannot prove, especially if they have secret sources, whistleblowing sources, they cannot prove that they have the evidence for a story, they can be punished, prosecuted, fined, imprisoned, or fired. And that results in massive self-censorship. So the punishment or the sanction available to the press ombud, which is the only the requirement of an apology, is not inappropriate. I'm going to come back to that. There's also an argument that the ombud is appointed by the press themselves through a press council. In other words, it's a form of self-regulation. The ANC questions whether the press can ever be player and referee. Yet this accusation is unfair or ill-informed. When the ombudsman conducts a hearing in South Africa, she or he sits with two people, one a journalist and the other a public representative. And the appeals panel, which you can go to if you don't like the ombudsman's finding, which is engaged either by the complainant or by the newspaper defending themselves, that is chaired by a non-journalist. She or he is a retired judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and when he or she holds the hearing, they sit with one public and one press representative. So the mechanisms that have been set up are not simply journalists reflecting on their own performance, and certainly at the appeal level is someone who is a retired Supreme Court judge. In 2007, the New Zealand Press Council conducted a worldwide survey and listed 87 countries with press councils and ombudspersons. One of its major findings was that 86% of them had adopted the self-regulatory method which has been adopted in South Africa. Thus, the vast majority of democratic societies believe, based on extensive experience, that self-regulation can and does work to ensure responsible reporting. So that first argument, that we have other mechanisms and therefore we don't need the tribunal, seems to me is valid and stands up to scrutiny. In South Africa too, the evidence is that the press ombud has indeed functioned effectively, eliciting apologies when necessary, alerting the public to shoddy reporting and investigation, casting doubt on the reputation of the occasional reporter, which is in fact a reporter's most prized asset. The press has an interest in preserving its collective credibility with the reading public. If the people cease to trust newspapers, the latter will have no role with respect to news, comment and analysis, and will quickly become simply sports and entertainment magazines. Handing over the appointment of an ombud or tribunal to a political structure or any organ of state would frequently create conflicts of interest leading to suppression of reporting. To quote the ANC discussion document on the need for a parliamentary media tribunal, it expressed concern that, quote, some factions of the media continue to adopt an anti-transformation, anti-development, and anti-ANC stance. and the track record of appointments of similar structures that should be immune from political interference, such as the SABC board or the director of the National Prosecuting Authority, clearly indicates the willingness of Parliament to exert its control over these structures that are supposed to be independent. Would a parliamentary-appointed tribunal have been able to remain neutral and immune to the pressure from MPs who were exposed through the press investigations into the Travelgate scandal? And would those MPs have reappointed the tribunal for another term? Would the media's persistent challenge to President Mbeki over the AIDS denialism have been tolerated by a tribunal who believed the president represented the national interest or the public good? Political oversight of the media is far more dangerous to the open society than the risk of self-regulation. Jeremy Cronin, defending the tribunal proposal recently, argues that the oversight panels appointed by Parliament can be neutral and will not automatically defend the interests of the ruling party. He points to the Chapter 9 institutions, such as the Human Rights Commission, which has a similar role of protecting public interest, often from government, yet these panels, also the Human Rights Commission and the Public Protector, yet they are appointed in terms of our constitution by Parliament. So the question is, if taking account of the critics, the tribunal were appointed and protected in the same manner as Chapter 9 institutions, and if its powers were limited so that it did not have the powers of punishment, but only had the powers of warnings and demanding apologies, would we then think that the tribunal would be acceptable? The answer is no, precisely for the arguments that underpin the requirements of the open society as indicated in the OSMI. The ideology underpinning the ANC's position is that the state has a duty, the ANC's position is that the state has a duty or perhaps even a right to harness all instruments of policy, all instruments that may shape public debate and criticism towards what the state believes to be the right goals. Thus the ANC argued in the position paper on the tribunal that the ANC was voted into power on a platform of service delivery that government should deliver: job creation, rural development, land reform, better education and health, and combating crime and corruption. It goes on to observe that these are not the stuff that sell newspapers and make news, but they are what people want, and therefore argues that the press have to be harnessed to this national task of government. More generally, the document proposes that because the ANC stands for progressive social change, we must take charge to ensure that they dominate the national discourse and that our voice is heard clearly above the rest, unquote. Newspapers should be, quote, instruments of transformation, unquote, in building a better South Africa. This is the totalitarian vanguard party view of development. Or less pejoratively, it's the Platonic benevolent philosopher King view of good government. It may even be the democratic view if these wise rulers have been elected in free and fair elections, as our rulers have been. But it is still an ideology that is antithetical to the open society because it has this view that a party or government knows what's best. The open society, on the other hand, shares Mandela's view when he was speaking to the International Press Institute Congress in 1994. He said the following, quote, "No single person, no body of opinion, no political or religious doctrine, no political party or government can claim to have a monopoly on truth. It has therefore always been our contention that laws, mores, practices and prejudices that place constraints on freedom of expression are a disservice to society. I have often said that the media are a mirror through which we can see ourselves as others perceive us, warts, blemishes and all." We should remind the current ANC leaders that Mandela went on to say, quote, "The African National Congress has nothing to fear from criticism. I can promise you," he said, "we will not wilt under close scrutiny. It is our considered view that such criticism can only help us grow by calling attention to those of our actions and omissions which do not measure up to the people's expectations and the democratic values to which we subscribe." Unquote. A parliamentary media tribunal will sound the death knell to the free flow of information, and hence the ability of the public to know enough to contribute to, criticise and challenge policy. hold government accountable for its decisions and actions of commission or omission, and ultimately to know enough to vote for change. If you start from the position that any ruling party does not have a monopoly on truth, then any restrictions and the consequent paucity of public debate can only lead to worse policies. That is, policies that are worse for the public good, as opposed to policies that are worse for the ruling party. The ideology underpinning the open society is one which doubts the wisdom of authority, one which believes in and arguably has demonstrated empirically the value of the marketplace of ideas, including good ideas, bad ideas, dangerous ideas, wacky ideas, a marketplace that needs to be quite distinct from and uncontrolled by any organs of state. Finally, a system which protects the press from any state policing serves the public good not only because in open society terms, not only because it promotes open society through denying that anyone has a privileged position on policy, but also because it performs a watchdog role on behalf of us citizens. We cannot go investigating every case of corruption, every case of poor performance. The press on our behalf ferrets out corruption in government and in the private sectors. It spotlights poor performance of CEOs and civil servants. It uncovers injustice and unpleasant facts, such as inequality, that some in authority would rather conceal. And a free press, and this is going to move me into the second point, the second issue to do with citizens' duties. A free press also confronts us citizens with images and stories that disturb us, that shift us from our comfort zone, so that we cannot put our heads in the sand and say we did not know what was going on. Ultimately, the free press makes us accountable as citizens for the improvement of society. And that is perhaps one of the most important roles of the press in a democracy, because it is citizens who must in turn hold their leaders to account. So in conclusion, on the topic of the proposed media tribunal, if there are concerns about the lack of responsibility among certain sections of the media, the way to address this is through improving the current system of self-regulation and possibly strengthening the ombudsman's powers in line with open society practice in most democratic countries. But more generally, there is a lesson here in the findings of the OSMI, and that is that the legal frameworks, which are reasonably secure, are also fragile, that powerful political interests can quickly subvert them, and that the only real safeguard of an open society is not the legal system, but the vigilance and active defence by the citizenry. And this brings me neatly to the other finding of the OSMI, what I said were the negative findings that I wish to address, namely that citizens, quoting the study, that citizens' engagement with formal rules and institutions, as well as government's commitment to preserving their integrity, are the primary threats to the openness of contemporary South African society. This passive or apathetic citizenry is the real enemy of the open society. Why and how did South Africa move from being such an active, revolutionary civil society in the 1970s and 1980s to such a passive one in the 1990s and 2000s? Well, there are many plausible explanations, of course, from the initial respectiveness during the honeymoon period, loyalty to our liberators, other priorities such as racial conciliation, general optimism and naivety, and many more. But we must recognize that we must become activists again. In responding to this challenge, the universities have a special role to play in challenging the threats to the open society. Firstly, they or we have a self-interest in protecting the freedom of speech, ideas, the press, the rejection of dogma, which is inimical to the idea of a university whose core mission is the search for truth. Threats to the free flow of information are a direct threat to the ability of universities to fulfill their roles in society. Secondly, the university today, as in the past, is regarded by society as the home for the pursuit of truth and independent thought. It is an important authority to which people turn for help in making sense of their natural and social worlds, for guidance on values, politics, and the future. Like its ancestor, the church, the university is expected to take on the role of moral lodestone. Society expects the university to play a leadership role within it, to be a counterpoint to the state, and indeed to religious authorities for knowledge, analysis, ethical guidance, and the university must take the responsibility for playing that role and recognize the authority that it has been granted to do so. Thirdly, universities can also promote democracy by educating their students, our future leaders, in critical thinking and in the skills of citizenship. It is for these reasons that universities and at the University of Cape Town, we vigorously promote the search for truth and equally vigorously defend academic freedom. Serendipitously, the Open Society Monitoring Index is being launched today on the very same day as UCT hosted the annual T.B. Davey Memorial Lecture for Academic Freedom, a lecture established in 1959 by UCT students to commemorate the fragility of academic freedom when the nationalist government closed the university to black students. We should not rely on a wait-and-see approach, allowing the tribunal to be introduced, see whether it interferes with press freedom, and then try to act. We need to be vigilant, proactive, and object. As a university, we need to add our voice where needed, especially where transparency and the right of the public to know may be compromised. And as citizens, we need to take heed of the OSMI's warning that our apathy is the greatest threat to the open society.